See You Now is a podcast highlighting the innovative and human-centered solutions that nurses are coming up with to solve for today's most challenging healthcare problems. Created in collaboration with Johnson & Johnson and the American Nurses Association.
It's very clear that AI is not going to replace the requirement for in-person appointments and surgeries and procedures. So my hope would be that this AI technology both makes it better for clinicians, makes it better for administrators, makes it better, probably most importantly, for patients and those using the services. And it's only through technology, or technology is probably the biggest lever for making current health systems sustainable going forward.
Welcome to See You Now. I'm Rebecca McEnroy, executive producer for See You Now. There is a palpable mix of excitement and anxiety about the latest impending wave of artificial intelligence. AI tools are being developed that will fundamentally impact our jobs, our relationships, our access to knowledge and creativity, our children's lives, and the planet. But for an industry like healthcare, where fax machines and pagers are common, where people struggle to find affordable care or adequate resources, and nurses are leaving the profession due to administrative burden and moral distress, can AI be an answer? In this two-part feature, The Clinicians Shaping Healthcare Technology, for our AI in Place series, host Oriana Baudet, Vice President of Innovation at the American Nurses Association Credentialing Center and Foundation, talks with a nurse and a clinician helping to shape the future of AI in healthcare for one of the largest technology companies in the world.
My name is Dominic King, and I'm the VP of Health at Microsoft AI, a role I've been in for about a year. I was born in Scotland, come from a family of teachers, but my dad was actually a publican, which meant he ran bars and pubs, which brought us down close to the outskirts of London when I was about 7 or 8. And no family in medicine, unlike most of the people that I ended up going to medical school with. I remember being struck. We had some family friends who were doctors, and their pager used to go off. And I remember thinking, I must be pretty exciting to have a job where people need and want you 24/7 and are resting on your expertise. I kind of probably changed my mind when I had my own pager a few years later. Worth calling out, though, in the UK, you go to medical school at 18, so you have to take the decision pretty early. So I think I was probably influenced by TV series like ER and various other things at the time, which was probably a push into medicine. It's not a story I've ever shared that ER was influential in me taking such an important life decision, but it genuinely was at the time. And I think I actually changed school subjects off the back of a particularly impactful episode. So, you know, for many of us, if you don't have that exposure, I mean, when we talk about, like, a lot of nurses and doctors have family members who are in practice, I have some of my closest friends, you know, used to go and do rounds with their parents on Christmas Day, etc. So they were exposed to this world that I had no view of at all. And so you pick that up, and it was more limited media exposure, I guess, 20, 30 years ago. But you see in social media now, you know, a day in the life of a nurse, a day in the life of a doctor. And, you know, these things are a day in the life of a technologist. What's it like to work at Microsoft or Facebook? I think getting a sense of these big, impactful, consequential life decisions, if you can get reliable, accurate, resonant information, I think generally it's a good thing to make sure that you're making the right pick in life. You know, the levers for change, I think, is really important. And I really encourage people to explore, like, when you find that lever that you really love. In my case, I tried lots of things and settled on technology. When you find that lever, finding the way of making that part of your day-to-day job, I think makes for like a really fulfilling and satisfying career. And so, yeah, would just encourage anyone listening to really delve into that and find ways of using it going forward.
Hey, Dom, thank you so much for being here and having a conversation with us about the work that you're leading.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Dom, what does a day in your life look like? You get up in the morning and grab your cup of coffee or tea or whatever you start your day with. What does a day in the life of Dominic King look like?
Much like what we would call in the UK, like an MDT meeting, which is working together with people across disciplines in a really meaningful way. Product managers, engineers, designers, marketing, comms, regulatory, legal. And so a lot of our work is centered around those types of collaboration. There's a fast pace of development at the moment in this space. And so people get very focused against specific problems, and we time box that. So we'll say, we would like to deliver this feature in 10 weeks' time. How are we going to make that happen? And everyone crowds around and makes that happen. And we're in the office collaborating, sitting in rooms together, which I'm super enjoying and was a part of what I enjoyed most about clinical practice. So, in summary, in the office, working, collaborating both internally, but also working with a lot of external partners and groups, and also enjoying spending time in different health systems and partner organizations, keeping up to date with the hard work to deliver care.
Dom, you're working in an incredibly fast pace industry. A lot of things have been dropping recently around other healthcare AI solutions, OpenAI Health, Claude Healthcare. What are your thoughts around what's going on?
Yeah, so particularly on the consumer health side, it has been very exciting in the industry. Maybe a couple of things to say. I think all the internet search and consumer health AI companions have all published similar data, which shows how much people are using these services for healthcare. What we've been seeing in the last integrations into electronic health records and wearables, I mean, this is just the start. And so it's no surprise that we're seeing, dedicated efforts and focuses, and that's the right thing. We all have a heavy responsibility to get this right around safety and trust, quality, and I think we're going to see really useful new tools and functions that really help people on the path to better health.
So, Dom, you started your career as a surgeon and researcher, and you've published extensively and co-founded a health tech startup that Google acquired. What inspired you to move from the operating room to the tech world? And was there a specific problem or aha moment along your journey that pushed you towards digital health and AI?
Well, I guess the common thread running through career decisions and moves is I've only actually ever worked in healthcare. And there's obviously many ways that you can have impact in healthcare. Clinical practices, as we all know, you can be an academic, you can work in policy, you can work in innovation in technology. And I've kind of tried many of them. And when I think about the different moves I've made, they've been a function of, I think, being kind of curious, problem orientated, and motivated by impact. And technology kind of hit all the right things for me. I still keep all the letters that I got from patients when I was in practice, and we don't get any letters now, right? We can talk about impact and tens of millions of people using our services, but no one writes a letter in. And so there's different ways of feeling that impact.
Dom, Sataya and Nadala talked about this emphasis around empathy and impact and Mustafa Suleiman's vision for healthcare AI. As you've made this move as a physician into this tech space, what are your thoughts around Microsoft's culture vision? Where do you fall in the midst of all of this with the work that you're leading and your own thoughts?
Yeah, so I moved into technology. I did a startup and then started working at Google almost exactly 10 years ago. And I think it's worth unpacking. The focus of our team is on building new AI models with a particular focus on patients and consumers. And if you look back 10 years ago, there was a period called the deep learning revolution, which was very good at classifying things in data. So a lot of early focus was on radiology. So I spent about 6 years at Google, and I think my reflection on that period was it felt quite distant from real world impact. There was a lot of research papers and interest and excitement at the time. And actually, between Google and joining Microsoft a year ago, I worked at Optum, part of UnitedHealth Group. And I think that in part was like a reflection of I want to actually feel like I'm back and having real world impact. Had a great time there. The move to Microsoft about a year ago was a function of a few things. One, generative AI, what people will be familiar with, AI companions and chatbots. The pace of progress has been incredible over the last few years, and I felt like I wanted to be part of that journey again. And then the opportunity to work with, you mentioned Mustafa Suleiman, who's my boss, who previously worked with before. He's really pioneered this thinking around kind of humanist superintelligence, which I think is so critical to how we think about AI in healthcare. He's always been passionate about healthcare, so when the opportunity came to get back into like a frontier lab and work with Mustafa and grow a health-focused team again, it was too exciting an opportunity to pass up.
Well, and team is everything, right?
Right.
And the ability to do the work that you know is possible. And, one of the things about Microsoft, they're known as a leader in accessibility and inclusive design. One of those great examples is Xbox and that adaptive controller, which really opened up gaming to people with disabilities. How does this commitment to inclusivity translate to healthcare? Are there principles or lessons around that accessible gaming that you're applying to healthcare AI? And how do we ensure that health tech and AI tools are inclusive, usable, and beneficial for everyone, patients of all abilities, clinicians on the front lines, including nurses and everyone, who says they aren't tech savvy?
Right. Yeah, the adaptive controller is a great example of designers and product teams thinking about customer base and user base and how they can reach as many people as possible. Co-design is probably the critical perspective here. And like, how do you build technologies that work with clinicians, with caregivers, with patients, with consumers? And I think products that will win and be successful are those that are built with and not just for users. And that means they need to be really grounded in real world lived experience. People with different literacy levels, English not as a first language, comfort or discomfort with using technology, sometimes, not easy access to the internet or the latest iPhone or version of the software. So, it's a really critical part of how we work. To do so really closely with users. Every week, we have in-depth discussions with a diverse set of users of different ages, of different backgrounds, with conditions, without conditions, learning from their experiences of using our products, how we can improve. And that feeds directly into our product roadmap. Part of that process is you learn what people are interested in. And so it may seem obvious, but for some people, that may be, does it take my insurance? For others, does that clinician speak my language easily? Some people may prefer for certain specialties to see a female clinician rather than not. And so we really brought that into our feature set and the way you filter and search for people that directly as a result of in-depth discussions with our users.
Where does that research take place? I'm just curious.
There's like a few key roles, like engineers that are building the software, product managers that help define what you're building, designers that work with end users and also design how the interfaces that make them useful. Very critical to our team is also making sure that we have clinicians and health experts in various guises as part of the team. And then we also have a panel of nurses, doctors, psychologists, other types of clinicians, as well as patients that we engage with. A lot of that happens virtually, and that's important for us to make sure we're getting a diverse set of people that we get to work with.
One of the headlines that just has bubbled up is Microsoft's recent partnership with Harvard Medical School to license health content for Copilot and aiming to provide more credible answers. Why is this partnership so important? And more broadly, what does it take to gain the trust of patients and healthcare workers in introducing artificial intelligence? And how are you ensuring tools which handle over 50 million health queries a day provide reliable, understandable, and clinically sound information?
Well, back to the focus on users, the decision for us to look at health information is a direct consequence of us understanding better what people look for when they come to the internet or use AI companions. And top of the list in health, I mean, worth also pointing out, and we released some data last month, which showed that health is the primary intent of our users. And the main reason they come to us is looking for health information. That's a function, as you'll appreciate, of how complex health is to understand and navigate. So the way we approached this was in a couple of ways. One, generative AI, which brings insights from lots of different sources, often is trained on the whole internet. Now, that can have positives, but also lots of negatives in terms of bringing in information that may not be credible or trustworthy. So, one approach we've used is to follow a framework developed by National Academy of Medicine to really prioritize well-established health systems and government bodies. But we also thought, some people just want an answer from a single reputable source. And that's really the basis for the Harvard partnership. Their experts, their nurses and doctors create content badged with their authority and reputation. And we present that as a side by side. So generative AI holds many advantages. It can help answer, long tail questions that you or me may have. And then alongside that, you have articles and information from Harvard. And love to speak to you in the future about which we see people getting most benefit of and using more.
As a physician, you took an oath to do no harm, and now you work in tech innovation where tools can be both healing and cause harm. To your point around, scanning the entire internet, right? There are pros and cons to this. So how do you personally navigate that oath in the context of AI development?
I mean, I look at the lens, particularly from a user's perspective, a patient or a consumer's perspective. A few things are really important. First of all, people need to be informed, particularly that AI is being used. I think it needs to be really clear, and it's not always as obvious as you think when AI is playing a role. There's been recent news in the last couple of weeks about the state of Utah approving AI to do repeat prescriptions. Now, that could be very exciting and save time and make the process easier, but that's clearly something that patients should know is happening. Patients need to be informed. They also need to be in control. A lot of that is about understanding how the AI gets to its decisions, something we call explainability, and something that we're really building into our systems. And then, really importantly to the point of your question is around safety. And I think there's a number of ways that we certainly approach that. We actually have a clinician on our staff who's an expert in clinical safety, and there's a real science and process to making sure that we're considering safety concerns, triaging them appropriately, exactly as you'd find in the hospital, and trying to mitigate problems again, like we do in clinical care. We don't wait till there's a safety issue. We try and identify it and pick up early. And I think quite core to that is also areas around cybersecurity, privacy, and making sure that sensitive information is respected as much as we would if we were delivering direct clinical care.
One of the pieces around, you talked about this diagnosis and the prescription process, and clinicians do more than diagnose. They interpret this ambiguity and build trust with patients in ways that AI can't. So how do you see AI fitting into this clinical workflow without losing that human connection? And talk about how you're engaging and working with nurses to develop these tools and clinicians. And can you describe how this collaboration works and what that sounds like and feels like in real time?
One way of measuring the performance or accuracy of AI is to use the same kind of approaches that we judge competency in a nurse, a doctor on. So an example would be the kind of USMLE exams that obviously physicians take in the US before they're able to practice. And over the last few years, we've seen tremendous progress in AI answering those questions to a point where they now pretty much get to as close to 100% as possible. The work we released a few months ago was taking much more complex cases, case proceedings, real world case proceedings published every week in the New England Journal of Medicine, and demonstrating that the AI systems could answer most of those successfully. Now, clinicians do much more than that. So we're certainly not saying that AI is able to get to those diagnoses without a clinician. That would be fanciful and not true. But clearly, they're demonstrating very advanced clinical reasoning capabilities that will only get better. So, as we think about the application of that clinical reasoning expertise, I think there's two main ways of thinking about it. Firstly, it can be delivered directly to care teams. And secondly, to consumers and patients using AI companions and chatbots. Just because you asked about the first, Microsoft's a big company. We have a dedicated team releasing dedicated nursing functionality for ambient technology, helping with nursing workflows, nursing notes. So that team, which is focused on those nurse-delivered solutions, I know has nursing leaders at the helm, as well as working hand in hand with rather than for clinicians and how they build things out.
It's exciting to see that these tools and resources are available for all clinicians, and especially when nurses are providing care around the clock, 7 days a week, and have the highest number of touch points with patients and with communities. One of the things, as we look at this conversation around high tech, high touch, we're hearing more and more about quantum computing and the breakthrough that that could pay for millions of qubit quantum computers. And while quantum is still emerging, how do you anticipate this emerging future and how it might impact healthcare?
So I will not claim to be a quantum expert, although yes, I have held the chip, which was a highlight of 2025.
Cool.
Yeah, it's got a very impressive but small piece of gold. But what I would say is there's a couple of key contributors to the rapid and major advances we're seeing with AI. Firstly, access to more and higher quality data. So for example, if we take radiology, getting richer and more annotated scans is very helpful. Secondly, better maths. That's usually coming from the kind of AI experts, the computer scientists and physicists and mathematicians we work for. And then third is access to compute power. So you may have seen recent stories about big tech companies opening very large chip centers. And I think the way you can think about that infrastructure and the need for compute is you can either have more chips or you can have better chips. Quantum is an approach of making faster, better, smarter chips, and they will be critical to these advancing capabilities. So for applications in healthcare, it may allow us to do more complex reasoning. If you think of diagnostic tests, rather than diagnose that there's already a problem, a tumor in a mammogram, it may help us spot the earliest signs of those. So it's enabling technology, but I think critical to where the future heads.
Well, and this is kind of putting on our futurist hat, but as a clinician, when you started, you know, this reality, this focus on superintelligence, quantum computing, and this bio or living intelligence, which is really the merging of AI, advanced sensors, and biotech, this was not a part of your training in medical school. So as you're casting forward, what are your hopes for the application when it's this comprehensive?
Yeah, I think when we talk about medical superintelligence, the way that we've talked amongst certainly our clinical team and peers is when you're a nurse or a physician, you have a choice where you choose either to be a generalist or a specialist. And you can get very, very specialized. You know, we're at the point where orthopedic surgeons don't just specialize in the knee, but sometimes a small part of the knee or the right knee rather than the left knee. And I think what we're excited about with this idea of medical superintelligence is that it has both breadth and depth. It can cover a broad variety of topics. People will come in and within the same day ask questions about their child and then also elderly relatives that they're looking at. So it goes across those specialities. And then if you want to go really deep in these kind of cases, one in a million diagnosis, it can also support that. Now, that's just in care delivery. I think there's also very exciting progress, as we've seen with various Nobel Prize awards in the last couple of years, protein folding, drug discovery, just incredibly exciting for the future of precision and more personalized healthcare.
Well, and I think this gets to this aspect of as the amount of technology and the depth of understanding increases, simultaneously, we have to balance who has access to that. And so these components of accessibility around those technology requirements, when we think about these advanced health AI tools, they assume a very robust internet connection, cloud computing, high-end devices. But what happens in low resource settings or even rural areas with limited connectivity, what's being considered to integrate low-powered tech solutions and cost controls into these innovations around AI?
Well, firstly, on this important topic, arguably the biggest challenge facing healthcare at the moment is the mismatch between global demand for healthcare and its very increasingly constrained supply. And generally, I feel very optimistic that these technologies will close that gap and make care services not just in developed systems and the world's most advanced systems, but for the billions of people around the world that don't have access to even basic medical expertise. So I think that's a starting point. The point around access to the technologies and tools to support that is very important. We should appreciate that the health systems are very challenged, and these are organizations where pagers and fax machines still exist in the way that they don't in almost any other area of our life. And the idea that AI can just drop in and fix all of that is not, no one would see that as realistic. So that, I think, leads to a lot of healthy skepticism from clinicians that are in those environments day in, day out. And they're like, look, I can't even send a message, or we have no mobile reception, but you think AI is going to fix all of this? So I think there is a disconnect there that having clinicians more involved in the process is important to fix. And the other major challenge is, I don't like the term, but pilotitis. There's a lot of innovations that get spun up, and you kind of prove that they work in a very small trial or part of the system, but never scale past that. And that's something, again, that I think clinicians would play a very integral role in saying, look, this works. What's the best way of us rolling it out? But what I would say is smartphones have become very ubiquitous. A few years ago, I had the fortune of spending some time traveling around a very poor part of India, looking at maternity services and the role that technology could play within some of those organizations. And personally, I was just struck at the time there were no EHRs and hardwired technology. But when you asked any clinic or any staff within those clinics, did they have a smartphone? They absolutely did. And they had a pretty good access to the internet even a few years ago. For sure, there are people in some rural and underserved communities where that is a problem, and we need to build for the 100%, even if it's the 97% that do. But these technologies are definitely getting eased to access. And I saw a report that came out of the University of Michigan last year that showed 55% of elders in the US had used conversational AI. So I think the trajectory is still moving towards broad access to this technology in a way that has not necessarily been the case in the past when we look at technologies that many of us have got used to.
In the United States, we have health facilities that are closing across the country, and we are seeing increasing costs and widening health disparities even within our own country. What is the role of artificial intelligence in closing these gaps? You talked about it from this international perspective of, again, low-resourced areas. What does that look like within countries that have an established infrastructure, but yet are losing those physical infrastructure? Structures where the technology might be utilized, and why is infrastructure still necessary in an AI future?
It's very clear that AI is not going to replace the requirement for in-person appointments and surgeries and procedures. I think it can help in many other ways. Current systems, and you call out the gravity of the situation that we're all facing now, so overburdened. So if you think of things like triage and seeking health information, we mentioned that 50 million people a day come to AI companions and chatbots. If you suddenly put those 50 million questions, or probably the billion questions, systems would be even more overwhelmed. So there's opportunities for AI and the front end experiences of those to dampen down in a good way and help with people's health questions and navigation, and potentially things like triage, that allows health systems and the different professionals that work on them to focus on really important high value work. And I think I'm not sure what your opinion would be here, but I think we've kind of got that balance wrong at the moment. If I think of my clinical experience, maybe 10% of the work I did was work that I was particularly trained to do. The rest of it was things that other people would probably be much better at doing. I think that's true of across nursing. I think it's true across physician workflows, and all the ones that mix between. So my hope would be that this AI technology both makes it better for clinicians, makes it better for administrators, makes it better, probably most importantly, for patients and those using the services. And it's only through technology, or technology is probably the biggest lever for making current health systems sustainable going forward.
So, Dom, finally, looking ahead at what excites you most about the convergence of healthcare and AI in the next decade, what do you think are the biggest challenges for healthcare today, and what motivates you?
So I think there will be growing problems that come from the demand as we get older and live with comorbidities. I see that in my friends and family that are having challenges accessing care, even in the developed advanced systems. And I believe that we're on a path to having AI that in many ways replicates a lot of the clinical expertise or the reasoning capabilities, not the hands-on care. And we really need to be really thoughtful about how we apply that. So I think working together between clinicians and technologists, between technology organizations and different parts of the health system, what's the best way we can apply these approaches and technologies to solve real problems? The risk, I think, is otherwise we create a lot of smart technology that doesn't really make sense, doesn't solve real-world problems, and we end up in 10 years' time in an even more challenging place than we currently find ourselves. I think technology has been very interesting within the medical professions because it's given us an opportunity to impact change outside of just our direct care responsibilities. And my experience is that the most popular societies within nursing and medical schools are no longer, the surgical society or the radiology group. It's the entrepreneur group, and we talk about doctorpreneurs and nurse hackers. And I just think there's a lot of interest and excitement in building these core capabilities, clinical experience alongside experience in tech. And it's very telling, and I think interesting and exciting that if you look at all the big tech organizations, they all have clinicians leading their health efforts, core parts of the team, and I think that lends itself to the solutions that we're seeing now. So in the case of ambient technology, solutions that clinicians are actually running out to get now in a way that they've never done before. And Mary's a great example of, a nursing leader who is building technology for the problems and challenges that she previously experienced herself, and I think, delivering products that ultimately work. So I'd love to continue seeing that. They're obviously important that people still practice, and that isn't going away. But I think developing these dual interests, whether it's in education, policy, management, is a way of us making sure that whatever levers are improving and changing healthcare, clinicians remain central to the process.
Special thanks to Dominic King, former surgeon and vice president of health at Microsoft AI, to nurse Mary Varghese Presti from episode 130, corporate vice president and chief operating officer of Microsoft Health and Life Sciences, and to host Oriana Baudette, vice president of innovation at the American Nurses Association Credentialing Center and Foundation. Conversations around the design, development, and deployment of AI tools in healthcare are not happening in a vacuum. Across the world's most respected medical institutions, from the WHO to the AMA, from the floors of Cedars-Sinai to the research labs of Yale, a shared and urgent truth is emerging. The people who deliver care must lead the design of the tools that will reshape it. Dominic King reminds us that clinicians across every discipline have long been spending the majority of their time on work they were never trained to do, and that AI's greatest promise is not efficiency for its own sake, but the restoration of something we are in danger of losing: the time, the presence, and the humanity at the heart of care. Mary Varghese Presti shows us what it looks like when that promise is honored and nurtured. Her perspective helps us understand the power of inclusive design and the possibilities AI offers for building, supporting, and sustaining a healthy, accessible, and thriving healthcare system. As we race toward this AI-powered future, being aware, being involved, intentional and transparent about the design and deployment of AI will build trust, avert harm in ways we might not predict or intend, and enable humans to flourish. The nursing voice is not one perspective among many. It is the voice most present with patients, and therefore the voice most essential to getting this right. Subscribe to See You Now wherever you get podcasts to make sure you catch every episode as we dive into the thrilling possibilities and daunting challenges of AI. For See You Now, I'm Rebecca McEnroy. Thanks for listening. Nurses are transforming healthcare through innovation, compassion, and leadership. And Johnson & Johnson is proud to continue its 125-year commitment to champion nurses through recognition, skill building, leadership development, and more. The American Nurses Association is dedicated to building a culture of innovation. Nurses improve the lives of patients and communities through innovative thinking, empathetic connection, scientific rigor, and sheer determination. ANA is proud to support and advocate for our nation's most valuable healthcare resource, our nurses. For more information on See You Now, visit seeyounowpodcast.com and listen to any of the earlier episodes in our library, wherever you get podcasts.